I'm Gary Nall. We're going to have an empowering show today, beginning with the University of Kansas Medical Center report about higher doses of DHA associated with a lower early preterm birth rate. 1,000 milligrams of DHA daily in the last half of pregnancy had a lower rate of early preterm birth than women who took the standard 200 milligram dose. This was a study funded by the National Institutes of Health. That's important. That saves an awful lot of suffering for the child and the mother. This is published in eClinical Medicine. We have a lot more, and that'll come in just a moment. But also today, we are pushing back. We are pushing back against the tyranny of the deep state, the corporate state, the ideological state, the political state, the financial state, who controls everything on health, not just COVID, not just vaccines. And it's unfortunate to see how many people are so willing to accept what they say without challenge, legitimate challenge. So today, an original commentary. Have the architects of the COVID-19 pandemic lost touch with reality? That is our commentary. It'll be posted after the program today on prn.fm and garynall.com. Please share these documentaries. And by the way, we saw that several thousand people downloaded a documentary called The Cost of Denial that also involves Anthony Fauci and how he mismanaged the war on AIDS and how there were natural non-toxic treatments administered by board-certified physicians over 15 years. Not a single patient died. Many had total health and remained HIV positive but with total health, but others, total health and no HIV, reversed it in 18 patients. That should have made news. It didn't. To the contrary, it was attacked. There was a blackout on it. No one in the media, the medical and scientific community, was allowed to attend, even though there was an open door press conference. So there is Anthony Fauci. So we're going to share that with you. And also today, new information on how the Wuhan lab was caught deleting files proving Fauci funded them. Oh, that should be interesting. And Richard Gale will be on the program a little later because now there's a big movement saying, okay, so you've maybe 40% of the American population, between 30 and 40%, have had COVID, the virus. Most had little to no symptoms, and therefore they fought the virus and they won. Now they're immune, possibly for life. But along comes brand new information saying, oh, no, don't count upon immunity from the virus. Get your vaccines, everyone, under all circumstances. There's no exceptions. Really? Do you have any science or medical background? Do you have the word of all the doctors treating people with cancer, organ transplants, all the autoimmune people who could die and be infected if they take the vaccine? No, of course you don't. And who's making this program? One of the most corrupt organizations in history, the World Health Organization. And why hasn't the mainstream media done what we've done? We've exposed the World Health Organization. We've exposed the FDA, the CDC. We've exposed Bill Gates. More to come. Good, Bill. I wish it was good news, but it's not. And there are 20 articles that have been written about you from outstanding journalists. We're going to be sharing those over the next week. But you wouldn't know that he wasn't one of the wisest people on earth, one of the most benevolent, one of the kindest, one of the most altruistic. He is none of the above. He's a scoundrel. Should be held accountable for his actions. We'll give you those actions that you have not heard of before. That will be all next week. By the way, next week, since I have not had a chance to look at the emails, since I've just returned from in-depth clinical study, I had hundreds of emails, and I finally went through them late last night after finishing the commentary for today. And so next week, beginning next week, for the next 10 days, I'm going to have a different women's health issue on, and I'm not just going to give a little bit of advice. It's going to be a classroom on the air, like 15 minutes or so, more or less, on every topic that people wrote about. So at least we'll get 10 important conditions that a lot of women suffer from and the natural non-toxic approach to these. That'll start next week. And then I've got a week following on men's conditions as well. So that's coming at you. Now, Richard Gell's going to be here to look at the actual science of immunology. So you're going to get a primer today on immunology. Then if time permits, by all means, call in and ask your questions. So now we know how, by taking DHA in larger amounts than normal, if you are pregnant and you're in the last half of your pregnancy, that that could help you not have a preterm, which frequently the child dies. From Emory University School of Nursing, an article published in the highly prestigious Cancer Journal, that's the Journal of the American Cancer Society, cancer treatments may accelerate cellular aging. Yeah, I'm glad they just discovered this. Everyone else has known this in the science world of anti-aging for a long time. Just attend any of the conferences that are held around the world, and you hear them talking by the thousands about two ways of approaching aging, what speeds up the aging process and what slows it down. Almost all the energy now is on developing some form of patentable treatment with stem cells. Now, there's a lot of good on stem cells, but I would rather look at the whole human being, and hence, that's what we're doing and have done. So, imagine getting chemotherapy and radiation. Both are carcinogenic. They actually cause cancer. I am doing an article now about the best and worst cancer treatments of orthodoxy. Nothing having to do with alternative, just orthodox medicine, show you what is likely to help you and what is likely not to. But you wouldn't know that. You'd think everything helps you because they wouldn't be giving it to you if it didn't. They have science on their side. They have pseudoscience. They don't have good science. But this is interesting because gene activity, according to Emory University School of Nursing, is often adjusted during life through epigenetic changes. And we've talked about epigenetics a lot. I'll give you just one simple example. It is not just physical. It is also very much psychological. I'll give you a very clear example. Let's say that you've grown up in an environment where possibly with what you perceive to be as good parenting, everything was about there's a shortage, and you don't want to be caught short. So make sure that you save and you spend every moment for the future, always planning. And that creates at some point an insecurity because you see that all the other things you assume would work in life, your marriage, that failed, your kids growing up to be really good, healthy, and balanced and able to succeed in a society without becoming one of the woke generation, that didn't work out so well. You pushed everything to the limit to make sure that everybody got good grades, but then that meant that there was a lot of other things they didn't learn about life, and now they are begrudging that fact. You look in the mirror and think, my God, I'm only 10 years older than what that picture out there might. I don't look so good. I don't feel so good. Yeah, because you didn't make your happiness the foundation of your life. You made success. You made financial stability. Talk with someone who's financially unstable, and here's the three answers you're going to get. I don't think I can afford that. I don't think that's, you know, I can't take that chance. And also, well, I can't control the outcome. It's the last point epigenetically that controls most people's lives. If I can't know what's going to happen when I change, why should I change? Better the devil I know than the one I don't. And so we maladapt in all of our comforts, in all of our communications, to saying, this is as good as it's going to get, or this is as good as I want it at this time. If you want to see a good example of that, travel around the United States to gated communities. You'll find people who are pretty successful, a lot of professional people, a lot of small business people. They've worked hard. They've been pretty darn good people. They're very conscientious. They're aware. They've taken the best qualities of their greatest generation, their parents, my parents, grown up during the Great Depression. They have good character. They're honest. And they have good morals. And they see the world changing so fast, and they thought they'd be dead and gone before the next generation took full control. And a lot of them are still working. They have to. And then ask them what is the one thing that they fear more than anything else, and that is not being able to control the circumstances in their life. Well, freedom, you have to have a freedom from the control of fear, insecurity, and uncertainty over your life, and freedom for being the architect of your own existence. What do you want going forward? Where would you like to live? Who would you like to have as friends? What don't you want to do? Make a checklist. I'm not going to do this anymore. Dot, 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 dot. I'm not going to take care of people who can take care of themselves. I don't appreciate never being appreciated for what I do for others. Ah, check it, check it, check it. And here's what I want to do. I want to learn about other cultures that I had no knowledge of. I want to learn how wonderful a world we are in. I want to see all the great places in this country. I never got to. I was going to, but I was too busy making a living. It wasn't a living you were making. You were pouring all your time, energy, and effort into a bottomless glass that will never fill, making you feel, now I've got enough to be enough to have the life I deserve. Almost everybody I've ever counseled in my life, and that's a lot of people, the one thing they say they failed at is living their own authentic life. They were the good daughter, the good sister, the good brother, friend. They were good for everyone else, and they were sincere in it. It just wasn't good for them. So now, take a look at what causes your body to age. What causes your DNA to age? Well, how about this? More than chemotherapy and radiation that this study's talking about, yes, it does age you prematurely, and it does kill off an awful lot of mitochondria. Hence, cancer patients are very fatigued and weak. It can cause secondary cancers that then a year later the cancer comes back, and now you have no immune system to fight it. Because these are not immune augmentative therapies. They might use the title immune in it, but not real immunity. And dare they never try anything that would challenge their own epigenetic conditioning. I've got to do the protocols that I was taught by the pharmaceutical reps or the best sayings that were encouraged by the state medical boards. Even if every patient dies, I must honor the system. Wow. Then you must have been reading 1984 as if it were not a novel, but a true story. So just be aware that what causes you to slow down the aging, I'm going to deal with in depth next week. By the way, next week I'm going to go back to video streaming too. I just got some new equipment and so I can do it now. So just understand that if you're taking traditional therapies for almost anything, you're going to prematurely age. And I think that's important that we understand that. Better news comes from the Federal University of Pelotas in Brazil. Blueberries and blueberry extract has the potential pharmacologic tool for preventing depressive-like behavior and neurochemical dysfunctions in this particular laboratory experiment. It turns off pro-inflammatory compounds. Who knew that blueberries could help people with memory loss, beginning of dementia, or Alzheimer's? But it does. That's good news. And so the more blueberries you consume, the more anti-inflammatory action is going to go on in the body. And that anti-inflammatory action can also protect your neurons. It's neuroprotective. And that's important. So have your blueberries every day, a pint minimally. And also, regular physical activity is linked to better organized preteen brains from Boston Children's Hospital. Yeah, data from 6,000 9 and 10-year-olds show positive effects on developing connectomes. Regular physical activity is simply really good on children's developing brain circuits. That's the bottom line. Physical activity of any kind was associated with more efficiently organized, flexible, and robust brain networks. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cerebral Cortex. That's good news. And study shows flickering lights, there's your light therapy, and sound could be new weapons against Alzheimer's. Georgia Institute of Technology. So for the past few years, they've been researching on flickering lights and sound to treat Alzheimer's disease in this research project, and it had good outcomes. Just go up and Google what you can do for the human brain, especially the sensory areas in the human brain that entertain itself to flickering stimuli for seconds to hours. And you want to see something really cool? I did this years ago. I took a group of people who had memory loss and dementia. And in fact, there was a fellow who built it for me, Raymond. And it was about 1975. And I put a wall. It was a beautiful water wall. And then I put lights behind it. So when the light was shining up as the water was coming down the wall, it flickered. It was really cool. And I put on some very soothing music, including thunderstorms and rain hitting a tin roof. And they would sit there for an hour and just focus upon that. And within about 40 minutes, they were all asleep. And we did this all, probably for about 6 months on a weekly basis. And it made a huge difference. People said it calmed them down. It gave them deeper sleep. They felt more rested and improved memory. That's not with anything else. So I'm aware of the power of that from a long time ago. University of Auckland, which is New Zealand, green tea and red wine can reduce cough and cold risk. A study by the university showed that eating flavonoids, and you get the flavonoids from blueberries, cacao, that's your chocolate, apples, and green tea, and onions and red wine being the least, can significantly reduce the risk of catching colds and coughs. And that is a big deal. 33% more protected against a common cold or upper respiratory tract infections. All good news there. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on Health and Healing. We're 16 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, a special commentary. And again, commentaries are only value if you find them important to you and you're able to then share them with other people. So let's start sharing all the information we have, because otherwise you're not going to find anyone out there who's able to help us. Why? Because Facebook and Google and Twitter, they're not going to allow any of this information on their servers. And I believe that we need this information, and we need it now. So let's take a moment, and we'll come back. Please stay with us. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to reverse it. Why? Because I have so much respect for this person, Chris Hedges. He is as close to a living oracle as we can get. He is courageous to a fault. He's very spiritual. He's deeply intellectual, but in a humanistic way, not in an arrogant, elitist way. And he wants to talk about who are the real victims of the cancel culture. And I've been wanting to do more on the cancel culture because it's spreading like a metastasized tumor. And thank you, parents, for standing up and going to school boards and say, I do not want my child taught purely, rabidly racist curriculum on Andy DeAngelo's book on white fragility. And that's happening everywhere. So get in their face and let them know that's not what a child should be going to school to learn. But it certainly serves an ideological benefit to those who don't like your values. So we're going to play something from Chris Hedges back in a moment. Please stay with us.
We're speaking today with Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, on his new article in Sheer Post titled Cancel Culture, Where Liberalism Goes to Die.
Cancel culture, as you see it, what is it and who does it serve?
Well, it serves, cancel culture is not new. Cancel culture was one of the primary components of red baiting. So that began after World War One. So you went after progressives, socialists, and communists, but they didn't have to be communist. Anybody with a social conscience, artists, Paul Robeson was hounded throughout his life, passport taken from him, all sorts of writers, including in Hollywood, Dalton Trumbo, Orson Welles left the country, Charlie Chaplin left the country, great journalists like I.F. Stone, Henry Wallace, 1948, the last candidate with maybe the exception of McGovern who challenged the military-industrial complex was destroyed. So it was a very effective way. And then you had the rise of this so-called Cold War liberal. So you had people like Sidney Hook and others who essentially outed other liberals. I mean, it'd be the liberal class disemboweled itself. Again, that my book, Death of the Liberal Class, kind of goes into detail about that. So cancel culture isn't new. Cancel culture is a very effective way to demonize other people and shut down voices. What happens in a society that doesn't work, like ours, is that you have a segment of the society that essentially seeks their moral purity, their moral self-justification by shutting down voices that they considered, to be politically incorrect, or they don't use the proper politesse, or they are, you know, don't embrace the kind of mainstream ideas of the liberal elite. You see this with the second wave feminists who've been, because they draw this line between trans people and women. I'm not going to get into that debate, but I mentioned Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. It's in the piece. They have been victims of cancel culture. You see the...
Yeah, that was actually, to pause there, that was a shocking part of the piece, that the cancel culture basically destroyed this place so that women who had been abused didn't have a safe place to go. The people who are canceling don't think about the outcome right. of the oppressed that right. they are Absolutely. Further well, oppressing.
Right, because it's a boutique kind of activism. So you saw Don McNeil at the New York Times, who I know and work with. He was taking a bunch of rich school kids. The New York Times organized these junkets for rich people. They make money off it. I mean, they have, my favorite is, I think you pay $35,000 and you get a private jet and you fly around the world to sites with a New York Times reporter. I mean, so anyway, they had a bunch of rich kids in Peru, and some of the kids, I wasn't there, so I'm going off of the New York Times version of events, which I suspect they wouldn't lie about. And some of the kids asked about an incident, a racial incident, where somebody had used the N-word. And Don responded to that question by using the N-word, which as a white man, he should not have done. But that's not a reason to fire him. And Dean Baquet, who's African-American, investigated and reprimanded him, and that was it. But then you had 150 staff members of the New York Times write a letter to management. And Don, by the way, was one of the forefronts of the guild, of the union, mm-hmm. protecting workers' rights throughout his career, and at moments, often at the risk of his own career, demanding that he be removed from the paper.
So the people that he defended demanded that he be removed yeah. from the paper. Yeah, well, yeah that happens to everybody.
Right. So that's a classic example of the... But at the same time, the New York Times is not confronting the real centers of power. Amazon, Bezos, the big banks, you know, the corporations on whom they depend for advertising, that institutionally are, of course, far more insidious in terms of racism and the perpetuation of white supremacy, but also in terms of their responsibility for the destruction of American democracy. So you get to kind of live in an institution like the New York Times, which is complicit, which slogged Russiagate, sold us the Iraq War, just did this racist podcast called The Caliphate, which was based on testimony by a guy who wasn't there. It was a complete hoax. It was a complete fraud, but it played to all the stereotypes of Muslims. So people ate it up. It was just, you know, these graphic descriptions. I mean, I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I smelled a rat from the moment it went up. But, you know, he was describing crucifying people and thrusting knives into their hearts and all this kind of stuff. But there's no kind of internal, there's nothing self-critical about it. And that's because the press, Matt Taibbi's written about this, has just siloed itself. And the Pew Center for Research did polls where I think it's 91% of the readers of the New York Times self-identify as members of the Democratic Party. That's 94% for MSNBC, 87% for NPR. And the inverse is true for Fox. I think it's 95% identify as the Republican. But then you're feeding people's prejudices and proclivities and opinions back to them in constantly more hyped and exaggerated forms. And that essentially you're creating a divide by which the country can no longer communicate, because there's no common language. There's no common definition of reality. I mean, this is why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa was so important, because it established a reality. I mean, they gave the white torturers and killers of the apartheid regime immunity to testify, but there was a brilliance in that, because it gave the country a common history, a verifiable history, one based in fact and reality, by which they could begin to rebuild their own country and their own narrative. And what we're seeing here is the breaking part, the destruction of that common narrative, and the media is completely complicit in that for reasons of profit, because the model now is not to, as in the old system of three major networks or a national paper like the New York Times, to reach a broad audience. The the object is to cater to your demographic, but more perniciously to set each demographic against the other.
It disturbs me greatly that liberals who are supposed to be pro-science, who are supposed to, you know, they see themselves as more enlightened, are actually doing the exact same thing that some of the more religious, more fanciful thinking folks are also doing, just picking up clubs and beating everyone. It's a shock to me.
Well,
I mean, they both go nuts. Like, no, I'm sorry. You know, yeah, I'm looking for, like, where are the sane people? You spoke in your piece about Reverend William Campbell, and you know, tell folks about who he was and why a figure like him would be basically crucified in the court of public opinion today. I mean, he's a reasonable human being. He was reasonable, and there's no room for that.
Yeah, I mean, as countries disintegrate and splinter, people who remain rooted in you know, a world that is not binary, not Manichaean, are completely eviscerated and destroyed by both sides. And that's, of course, precisely what's happening. So who was Will Campbell? He was a Mississippi Baptist priest or preacher who very early on, and, you know, remember, he lived in Mississippi, he's from Mississippi, was championing desegregation. He was the director of religious life at the University of Mississippi. He's fired because he calls for integration. He's one of the four white people who escort the black children through a hostile mob in 1957 to integrate Little Rock's Central High School. He was the only white person Martin Luther King invited to be part of the group that founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was involved in integrating Nashville's lunch counters. He helped organize the Freedom Rides. And at the same time, and he received tremendous death threats because his own society defined him as a race traitor. At the same time, he was by his own definition, and I knew him, an unofficial chaplain of the KKK. And
now the heads explode.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just
right,
not a thing right now.
So he denounced publicly and put his own life on the line to fight the Klan's racism and terrorism. And he, of course, marching with black civil rights protesters in Mississippi. But he said, we can't cancel white racists out of our lives. We can't demonize them as less than human. And that while this form of racism is evil, of course, it's not as evil or as insidious as a capitalist system that perpetuates the economic misery and instability that pushes people into extreme acts of violence or extremist groups. You know, as John Lewis wrote the introduction to the new edition of the book, Brother to a Dragonfly, which was a very important book for me when I read as a seminarian. It's also beautifully written. He was quite a talented writer. And as Lewis said, that, you know, Wallace reminded them that the same social forces that created the Klan had created the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and that nothing would happen in terms of real social change. There would be no real healing or equity unless there was liberation for all. And what's interesting, and Jimmy Carter also wrote an introduction and talked about how Campbell had worked to tear down the walls that separated white and black Southerners. This is exactly what Fred Hampton, the great Black Panther leader, was doing in Chicago. He was building a coalition with poor whites in Chicago and Hispanics. And that, for that reason, of course, the FBI burst into his house after drugging him and assassinated him. That becomes extremely dangerous to the power structure of the state. And I myself, much of my mother's family comes out of rural Maine. They you know, are suffering economically tremendously. That is sometimes expressed in ways that I find repugnant. Writing these people off is very dangerous. And I think that everyone should look at the Washington Post article where they got the court records for 125 defendants who were charged with taking part in the Capitol assault, and found that 60% of those facing charges reported signs of serious money problems, including bankruptcies, evictions, foreclosures, inability to pay debts, unpaid taxes, etc. And if we don't address that root cause, that dislocation, those rupturing of social bonds, then this extremism will only expand and become even more violent. I mean, I really worry about, and I hope I'm wrong, but I saw a very similar process when I covered the war in Yugoslavia. I really worry about political assassinations. And we've had several close calls already.
That's just one half the interview. I'll play the other half on an upcoming program. But he reminds us of several important deeper thoughts than what it seems the media and those pundits who are yelling racist about everything today and polarizing people. And you don't have to be a deeply convicted peace activist to see where this is going. If you keep harping that someone is born of a gene that makes them less than a human being and more aggressive in their very nature, no matter what their background and no matter how they've been taught and how they've interrelated in this world, there's going to come a point where it's going to be a flash, boom, and then you're going to have a whole new and completely preventable race riot. To deal with racism is absolutely legitimate. To say that everyone who's Caucasian is a racist, well, it's just mind-numbingly stupid and it's wrong. And that's what he's saying. He's just giving us a few examples. But then again, he no longer has the same place of respect within the liberal community he once had because he began to challenge some of their views. Now to an article that Richard Yale and I have written. It is entitled, Have the Architects of the COVID-19 Pandemic Lost Touch with Reality? As the pandemic wages into its second year, two diametrically opposing movements have consolidated in defiance against each other. The dominant contingent, represented by President Biden, Congress, Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, and the mainstream media, all of it, has decided that any citizen who refuses a COVID vaccine is a de facto enemy of the state. Quote, ultimately, Joe Biden declared during another gaffe remark about the status of the government's vaccination campaign, quote, those who are not vaccinated will pay, end up paying the price, end quote. What does that mean? Is that a threat? Despite the dubious claims that the RNA vaccines are approximately 95% effective, the unvaccinated therefore mysteriously pose a health risk to the vaccinated. Consequently, any punitive actions the federal and state governments undertake, including encouraging the social media to publicly shame and censor voices of caution and reason, are justified. In an effort to marginalize and socially victimize Israeli citizens who have postponed or refused or cannot for medical reasons receive a vaccine, Netanyahu and his right-wing Knesset supporters have passed a bill permitting personal information and data about unvaccinated citizens to be shared across government agencies and civil institutions. Israel was named by Pfizer CEO Albert Pourla as, quote, the world's lab, end quote, for the company's COVID-19 vaccine rollout. Contrary to the government's response to criticisms, the unvaccinated are theoretically second-class citizens, branded with the scarlet letter, depriving them of full engagement in Israeli society, including going to a restaurant, attending a movie, concert, or athletic event. Many are unable to shop or go to their workplaces. Even the staunch pro-Zionist New York Times indicated the government's policies are, quote, moving in the direction of a two-tiered system for the vaccinated and unvaccinated, end quote. An analysis comparing Israel's COVID-19 infection and vaccine-related deaths conducted by Dr. Herve Sigelman, an Israeli national at Marseille University of Medicine faculty of emerging infectious and tropical diseases, concluded that the Pfizer vaccine has, quote, caused mortality hundreds of times greater in young people compared to the mortality from coronavirus without the vaccine, and dozens of times more in the elderly, when the documented mortality from coronavirus is in the vicinity of the vaccine, thus adding greater mortality from heart attacks, strokes, etc., end quote. Seligman and his co-author, Haim Yadav, have referred to Netanyahu's draconian policies with unsafe experimental vaccines as, quote, a new Holocaust, end quote. A civilian organization, the Israeli People's Committee, which includes many health professionals and scientists and physicians, released a devastating report on the number of injuries and deaths resulting from Pfizer's vaccine. It was during the peak of the government's vaccination campaign that Israel experienced its highest death rate, especially among those between 20 and 29 years of age. The committee reported, quote, 26% of all cardiac events occurred in young people up to the age of 40, with the most common diagnosis in these cases being pericarditis, end quote. Other adverse vaccine reactions, including infarction, stroke, miscarriage, impaired blood circulation, and pulmonary embolisms. Nevertheless, Israel has become the poster child for far more than serving as Pfizer's experimental laboratory of human ferrets. It also models a caste society of haves and have-nots, the rewarded and the repressed, the vaccine-anointed and the untouchables, as strategized by the World Economic Forum's future technological proposals in its Great Reset. Netanyahu is seemingly fully bought into Schwab's Fourth Industrial Revolution and its revising of the very definition of the human species. Last October, during the World Economic Forum's Great Reset virtual session, Netanyahu appeared with Colombia's far-right president, Ivan Dungu, polled as the least popular president during that nation's history, and Rwanda's war criminal Paul Kagame, along with executives in the biotech and financial industries, to advocate on behalf of the forum's mantra that the pandemic is, quote, an opportunity, end quote, to further mobilize global digital infrastructure systems, including COVID-19 vaccination verification via microchip technology. Now we're witnessing Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States aggressively mimicking Israel's heavy-handed policies to establish full-spectrum social control and make efforts to implement a postmodern, technologically driven caste system. Although Biden stated he does not support a federal mandate on vaccination passports, it has been left to the individual states to decide. Democrat-controlled states, notably New York, are using vaccine passports is a ticket to allow the vaccinated to return to a new normal. Republican governors, on the other hand, have been quick to denounce them, and in the case of Arizona, Florida, Idaho, Montana, and Texas, to exclusively ban them altogether. Hopefully, some of the bans would challenge many of the over 100 private colleges and universities that decided to require students to be vaccinated before returning in the fall. The mainstream corporate media, led by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Daily Beast, the U.S. News and World Report, CNN, NPR, and MSNBC, spew volleys of baseless propaganda that the vaccines are effective and wholly safe. However, thousands of medical school professors, physicians, and researchers worldwide are challenging this non-consensual assumption. They regularly point out that there is no reliable science to justify any such claims. This raises the question, what are the vaccines effective against? Surely not contracting SARS-CoV-2, thousands of fully vaccinated people are testing positive with the infection. The CDC has reported, quote, 7% of those vaccinated who have been infected have been hospitalized and 74 have died, end quote. Government efforts to reach a fictitious herd immunity threshold will inevitably come at a great cost to human life. More recent studies suggest that an exceedingly large percentage of Americans should technically be exempted from COVID vaccines. The University of Michigan published a recent analysis in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Network Open suggesting that 3% of vaccinated Americans taking immune-weakening drugs have an increased risk of hospitalization. The study is grossly conservative and undermines the breadth of the problem. The researchers only analyzed patients with private insurance under the age of 65 and who were only prescribed immunosuppressive steroids, such as corticosteroids or prednisone. Other immune suppressive drugs, such as selective immunosuppressants and interleukin inhibitors, were seemingly excluded from the Michigan analysis. 33% of the American population was therefore excluded from the study because, according to the CDC, only 66.8% of the population has private health insurance. New York University researchers reported in the British Medical Journal that a third of the patients receiving methotrexate and TN tumor necrosis factor inhibitors for immune-mediated inflammatory illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis failed to achieve sufficient antibodies from the Pfizer vaccine. We are certain this would be found equally true for many other medications if and when they are conducted. The CDC's belief that only 4% of Americans are immune-compromised is a misleading underestimation. The agency's defining criteria is narrow and limited to HIV, AIDS, and cancer patients, inherited genetic diseases, and patients who have undergone organ transplants and are prescribed immunosuppressive drugs. On the other hand, there are over 100 different autoimmune conditions, including type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, blood cancers, lupus, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid and other types of arthritis, psoriasis, IgG4 diseases, Hashimoto's and Addison's disease, celiac disease, etc. These additional individuals, who account for over 50 million Americans, have multifunctioning and malfunctioning immune systems that increase their susceptibility to both severe SARS-CoV-2 infections, if left untreated during its early stage, and a higher probability of vaccine adverse reactions. Consequently, a very conservative 17% of Americans are at greater risk from either viral infection or vaccine injury or death. This also excludes tens of millions of adults, about 30%, and children, 40%, with chronic allergies, and many of the older, over 89,000 cancer patients diagnosed annually and prescribed chemotherapeutic drugs. Every year, nearly two-thirds of all Americans require emergency medical care from allergic reactions alone. Furthermore, those with certain immune weaknesses are less likely to generate sufficient vaccine-induced antibodies, therefore making COVID-19 vaccination ineffective for them. Especially disturbing is that the clinical trials the FDA relied upon for emergency use authorization for the past 5 months of vaccination were based upon enrollment of healthy individuals. Only recently are clinical trials either underway or in recruitment to test vaccines on participants with weakened immune systems, including small children, infants, and the pregnant. In the meantime, millions of immunosuppressed people diagnosed with autoimmune conditions or pre-existing comorbidities from young to old are being indiscriminately injected. Given the CDC's previous track record of reckless and wholesale vaccine policies, upon these trials' completion, we will surely see vaccination forced upon every infant carelessly. This has been a policy enacted so far on the elderly, the sickly, the immune compromised, pregnant moms, and the rest of the nation. It is not irrational, therefore, to suspect that past and present COVID trials have been conducted with malice aforethought and with the unconditional approval of our federal health agencies. During the pandemic, the rapid ascent of our vaccine-addicted culture's mantra of vaccination at any cost truly borders on medical malfeasance and criminal negligence. The overriding emphasis on vaccination and near total disregard for implementing very simple preventative measures to inhibit infections progressing in severity. In our health policymakers, or if they were wise men and women, alternative treatments such as ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and more recently inexpensive off-patent drugs, which have been shown repeatedly in multiple tests, hundreds and hundreds of tests with thousands of scientists and hundreds of thousands of patients. And yet the mainstream media has simply backhanded all of it. Federal authorities denied it. The World Health Organization tried to suppress it. And yet they have been proven by the best standards to be highly effective for early stage treatment and being widely prescribed elsewhere in the world. And yet they should be permitted and encouraged without reservation. Science is on their side. There would be no reason to wait for a novel drug costing thousands of dollars per patient per treatment to arrive. And we still wait that magic bullet drug because the previous one, remdesivir, was faulty and shot blanks. This is just another example of the institutionalized pathology that inflicts our health agencies. There is no convincing science to support our federal officials' belief that a previously infected person requires COVID-19 vaccine to acquire immunity. In fact, more recent research indicates the opposite and goes directly against the intellectually fetid arguments of the now disgraced financier Bill Gates that every person on the planet should be vaccinated without exception. John Hopkins professor, Dr. Marty Makary, has put forth the evidence that, quote, natural immunity works, end quote. Makary notes that it is only the rare instance when a person is being reinfected. Washington University School of Medicine reported this month that even mild corona or COVID-19 infections induce long-lasting antibody protection. The study's lead author, Dr. Ali Elbedi, stated, quote, last fall, there were reports that antibodies wane quickly after infection with a virus that causes COVID-19, and mainstream media interpreted that to mean that immunity was not long-lived. But that's a misinterpretation of the data. It's normal for antibody levels to go down after acute infection, but they don't go down to zero. They plateau. Here we found antibody-producing cells in people 11 months after first symptoms. These cells will live and produce antibodies for the rest of the people's lives. That's strong evidence for long-lasting immunity, end quote. The information we were fed to downplay natural immunity was wrong at best and more likely a lie. In order to further persuade the public into the importance of the vaccines to return their lives to normal. Another study appearing in this month's Journal of Infectious Diseases found that, quote, SARS-2 specific immune memory response following infection persists in most patients nearly 1 year after infection, end quote. The COVID-19 vaccines can't make the same promise. In fact, more reports show that fully vaccinated persons are becoming infected. But it gets worse. The pro-vaccine argument wrongly assumes that anyone who refuses the COVID vaccines is therefore anti-vaxxer. We would argue it is rational caution in the face of a national healthcare system indebted to the pharmaceutical industry and that is rapidly losing public trust. Likewise, if a doctor is successfully treating hundreds of patients, which many are, without a reported death with cheap and effective drugs, he or she is canceled and ridiculed as a quack. Instead of open dialogue and debate, those who challenge the medical church dogma are censored by Google and from all social platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, and Wikipedia. This is despite the impeccable credentials of many medical professionals abiding by the precautionary principle and dare to challenge Anthony Fauci and the global vaccine czar, Bill Gates, whose faux philanthropy is nothing less than another profit-making enterprise, in our opinion, like Microsoft. Conflicts of interest, both financial and non-financial, are endemic in our medical system. Therefore, it becomes increasingly more difficult to trust any clinical study or government policy that is based upon flawed evidence submitted by a drug maker that fails to undergo a thorough, independent, and impartial review by qualified medical doctors or experts. There is a clear psychological reason for this. Many psychologists have pointed out over the years that cognitive bias, motivated reasoning, and the other types of driving evaluation mindsets of clinical trial data and the subsequent institutional regulatory review and decision-making are deeply contrary and undermine the entire evidence-based criteria that should oversee what drugs, vaccines, medical devices, therapeutic protocols should be recommended or approved for use upon the public. The late Scott Lilienfeld, a professor of psychology at Emory University, writes, quote, clinicians are subject to the same errors in thinking that affect virtually all people, In particular, practitioners must be wary of the misuse of certain data, also cognitive biases, confirmation bias, hindsight bias in their everyday work, end quote. Although Lilienfeld is singling out clinical physicians, it applies far more rigorously and accurately to the pharmaceutical presidents, CEOs, and chief science officers overseeing vaccine development who have stock prices to reach and shareholders to please. Cognitive bias equally plagues the entire executive hierarchy of the CDC, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the FDA, and Health and Human Services, who are beholden to the gaping, revolving door between these agencies and private industry and their revenues. Writing about the deep ethical concerns behind bias in our medical institutions, Dr. Thomas Murray, president of the Hastings Center, states, quote, for scientists on a panel of the Food and Drug Administration, for example, it is immediately clear to whom they owe their primary loyalty, end quote. Such biases, Murray believes, have completely destroyed the credibility of the World Health Organization. We would concur. In conclusion, the fact that rates to reproduce medical clinical trials are so poor, according to behavioral economist Susan Felder at the Max Planck Institute, it is, quote, cognitive biases may be a reason for that, end quote. It also explains why Stanford University Medical School professor John Ioannis argues, quote, most published research findings are false, and, quote, an estimated 85% of research resources are wasted, end quote. Such junk science based upon bias should also include every vaccine application submitted to the FDA for regulatory approval, since the vaccine companies are privileged to cherry-pick whichever trials they want to submit to create the most promising portfolio. One could review all the official decisions made during the last 17 months by Anthony Fauci, Trump, and Biden, and the naive stances in both political parties, and should easily observe the frailties of cognitive bias and repeated contradictions throughout. None whatsoever are reliable, truthful. And of course, cognitive bias leads to cognitive dissonance, such as denying that one has a bias or resorting to flagrant rejection and disparagement in order to avoid any scientific data that conflicts with one's own held biases and unfounded beliefs. We now live in a nation of medicine by bureaucratic decree rather than by immunological science. This is a postmodern cultism at its worst because it hides behind the veneer of being scientific, and it has the full support of a political technocracy that can ordain authoritarian laws. There is a dire need or a collective epiphany. All of us are experiencing the pandemic as a failed experiment orchestrated by institutions that have lost touch with reality. And yet they won't stop. They won't change. They won't apologize. They won't acknowledge their errors. And it has been a very deadly experiment due to the extraordinary incompetence of our entire medical degree bureaucracy. Sadly, the decades of institutional ineptitude has had to reach national and perhaps global awareness at this time when the powers that possess every technological tool at their disposal to conduct wide surveillance pass undemocratic and draconian laws with full impunity and control the penned sheep within the mainstream media. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to say goodbye to our WBI listeners so they can catch the news top of the hour, and we're going to continue. Joining me now, and you can go to prn.fm to continue, Richard Gale. Richard, the establishment is on full force, and all the media is saying that, for all intents and purposes, that you get COVID and you get immune for life. Don't take that seriously. It's only the vaccines that are going to really give you the right immunity, and therefore it's only vaccine immunity that counts. You've examined the scientific literature. What does it show?
First, what they're stating is to just kind of go along and further support the changes that were made by the World Health Organization in December, just at the immediate time when the vaccines were being rolled out, and they changed the definition of herd immunity. They eliminated that herd immunity could be achieved by infection, and it was just insisting that herd immunity only comes solely from vaccines. But we have seen that if we were to do a comparison, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines only offer immunity up to 6 months at best. Okay, there are claims are saying that it could be 2 or 3 years, but we know that's not true. There's no science to support that. And even if we were to look at the World Economic Forum, I found a report that they put in April stating that eventually we're going to see COVID, the coronavirus, is very much like the flu. Immunity perhaps waning quickly, although science doesn't seem to agree with that. But what World Economic Forum states, that experts don't know yet how long COVID vaccines will be effective. So this is their quote, and that the studies of two of the most prominent COVID vaccines suggest that they remain effective for only about 6 months. Okay, so in the article you just read, there was the reference to Martin McCary at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He said that there's been this general dismissal of the fact that more than half of all Americans have now developed natural immunity to the coronavirus, and that it constitutes what he calls one of the biggest failures for our current medical leadership. There was the Washington University School of Medicine study also that was mentioned in the article we just wrote, that stating that the immunity can last if you become infected for the rest of your life. There was in Israel, the infectious disease unit, Suda Medical Center, and this is kind of important, it's a side thing, but they're saying that these serological tests that are being used to calculate this kind of mysterious number of months or years of immunity are completely unreliable, because immunity, an important thing to remember, immunity doesn't require antibodies. There's many recent studies that are showing that while COVID antibodies generally fade within 4 to 8 months, but the body can still remain immune to reinfection in the vast majority of cases. So that's really meaning that the level of antibodies doesn't accurately predict whether or to what extent a person is immune. And there's a lot of other studies that have been supporting this. There was a Duke study from Duke Medical School showing that it was published in The Lancet, that individuals with low levels of neutralizing antibodies can still be protected from COVID, even if they have a robust T cell immunity. There was a study at La Jolla Institute for Immunology stating the protective immunity against SARS-CoV-2 could last over 8 months. That was an earlier study. Subsequent studies that we're seeing are now putting it a year and even further. There was a Monash University study in Australia that, again, the data is showing that it lasts up to a year. Virologist University at Cambridge says that there's growing, and this is kind of another important one too, growing evidence suggests that people with cancer and other conditions that challenge their immune systems may be incubators for mutant viruses. I thought that was an interesting study just to show, because where there's a lot of concern about these new variants. And the problem is that there's no scientific, nothing really credible and certain saying that the Pfizer, the Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, or Moderna vaccines can protect against these variants. You'll see things in the news trying to make that statement just to get people vaccinated. But you have to do long-term studies. And remember, just these clinical trials that all these vaccines are based on, they were just recruiting and getting them underway last summer, and then actually conducting the studies in beginning in late August and through September, and then in middle of October, they're starting to put out all these reports on the vaccine's efficacy. And it's just insanity to even think that one could even believe any of this stuff is having any scientific credibility.
Richard, my biggest concern is that historically, vaccine makers have selected only healthy people for their trials, excluding unhealthy people. That was also true substantially for these. It's changing now. But then after the vaccine comes on the market, then everyone, including the people they wouldn't allow to be tested, are now expected to get the vaccine with no precautionary note at all. You don't have a pharmacist, a nurse in any of these drugstores. You have no one saying, let me give you the side effects. Let me tell you, here's how many people have died in the United States. Here's how many people have died in the European Union. Here's how many injuries. Here's how many serious and life-threatening injuries. Here's how many permanent disabilities. And you start looking at these numbers and you think, wow, 5,000 in the United States, more or less, and several hundred thousand injuries, and over 1,300,000, approaching 1,300,000 injuries, and over almost 13,000 deaths. Well, together, and you include in their life-changing injuries, you're dealing with a very high mortality rate, and that should have been immediately to stop the trials until all these variables are figured out, and then include people who have all these sicknesses in trials who want to participate, so at least you get a more honest review. Also, look at the study from Israel that I cited in the article of young people dying, far more people dying from the vaccine than was dying from COVID. Why aren't the mainstream media touching any of this? Why isn't Anthony Fauci, any of the public officials at the CDC, FDA, World Health Organization, saying, hold on a second, we didn't anticipate any of this happening, but it has. Shouldn't we stop for a moment? Or they're going to keep with this mantra of, so some people died, but they'll never give the numbers. And so some people were injured, and people who have life-changing injuries, who are going to be spending the rest of their life in this injured position, maybe we should pause. And they're going to say no, all full ahead. Your final comment.
Well, just on the last note, what's kind of interesting is that we were being told, anybody who held to the scenario that the virus had escaped Wuhan or that it was engineered, was just completely marginalized. You know, Facebook and all the social media were blocking and censoring anybody who was coming up with that, proposing that. And now Facebook just turned around and now they're included. It's included. New York Times is bringing it up. Biden is even. So what were once conspiracies are now real, viable realities in a way. And I think we're going to see this kind of continuing because the entire edifice of so-called science upon which the pandemic paradigm that's being dished out by the mainstream media right now is on a foundation of sand. And it's just a matter of time in which, more and more doctors coming out and like, Peter Doshi at the British Medical Journal, and to just really just kind of discredit it, digging and troweling out the sand from underneath this edifice that's just going to eventually just crumple into the ocean. So,
that's what we hope for.
That's the good news.
Richard, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your contribution. Again, today, go to GaryNall.com or PRN.fm, download the article and share it as far as you can. Watch The Cost of Denial, the new multi-award-winning documentary. And an outstanding program coming to you right now is Utrice Lead.